Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 393, Science Faction BPA time.
BPA time almost sounds like it's a professional sports organization.
Right.
Bowling prime time.
That's
Bowling Pro Association.
Okay, yep. There we go.
It reminded me of, you know, that fake ad that Bill Murray does in Lost in Translation with the whiskey? Make it Centauri time. But this is like, you know, make it plastic time.
Exactly. And speaking of plastic time, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. And with me, as always, my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. It's great to be back after last week. And I actually missed the episode because I was getting a bunch of plastic surgery.
That will fit right into what we're saying. Not at all. Just the word plastic has nothing to do with anything we're saying.
So I got these ass implants for nothing?
And the king of ass implants for this podcast is none other than our science guest host for the afternoon, Bill. Bill, how you doing?
I'm feeling like a human for the first time in like 4 days.
Before you were just all ass, right?
Yeah. It was fully plastic
you
ass.
You sound a little bit under the weather.
I'm a little under the weather. Or I was under the weather. I'm now just like peeking over the
just
top of the
just slightly above the clouds.
He said this, like, Bill had to take a bunch of opiates just to get through the door. He doesn't care how sick he gets you and I. He just cares about communicating with the Science Faction fans.
That
you
is
know
right.
What? I'll take your flu for that.
That is right. Is this the flu, Bill?
I got the flu vaccine. That doesn't mean that it isn't the flu.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, it only has lasted like 4 days.
Okay.
And I feel much better now.
Probably just a bad cough.
Yeah.
Probably just a bad cold. And you know, you're frail. You're too much of a scientist. You don't have the strength to fight it off.
That's true.
Is it throat gonorrhea? Did you go down on somebody who shouldn't have, Bill? Like
the cough,
me?
The cough.
I can tell you it's not me, but you should have gotten throat gonorrhea from me, Bill. That's all I'm saying. Just go off the episode, Bobby.
And if you guys want to get throat gonorrhea, come on out to my live show this Tuesday, January 7th. It will be the first nerd night that I am in charge of at our new location at Ken Club starting at 7 p.m. Damien will actually be there at the door, so if you want to meet both of us, come on out to the Ken Club Tuesday, January 7th, 7 p.m. for Nerd Night. We actually brought back our highest-rated speaker of all time for San Diego Nerd Night, Paul Wins.
Alex Jones.
No, he's not allowed in the building anymore. We brought Paul Wins back.
Did he put his testicles on the desk at some point?
It's my desk now. Let me tell you, I'm a red-blooded American, and I marked my desk like my forefathers did.
First of all, that wasn't even the beginning of the problems. That's not even a rare thing. He refers to a desk as a testicle stand, right?
Yeah.
I was very surprised that this could also be used for writing on it, just general work.
He thought coasters was a ball cozy. That's what he thought it was. That's why they're there.
Yeah, I tried using an ashtray. Wouldn't recommend that. People try to ash on your nuts all the time.
So come on out to the Ken Club this Tuesday, January 7th at 7 p.m. Like I said, we're going to have our top-rated speaker of all time, Paul Wins. He's going to be talking about using math to be a badass pilot. Science trivia is coming back. We're doing new games. We have a bunch of fun surprises. And most importantly, this is my first thing, taking this show over and moving it. So if you want to support me, come on out, please. We have a link on our website to tickets. And I'll see you this January 7th.
And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, go ahead and give my Dungeons & Dragons podcast, Awful Neutral, a shot. I have 7 of San Diego's funniest comedians and myself playing a tabletop adventure. It's very fun. Give us a listen. I promise you'll like it.
That is not true. It is almost certainly nerdy and unlistenable. All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
You wound me, Bobby.
I bite my thumb at you, sir. All right, article number one. BPAs are real SOBs.
That's harsh. Harsh language.
It is. And you know what? Deserving.
The intro to this article section has been very negative just from the start. Can we reset?
Yeah. So BPAs, bisaerophol A, you guys might have heard this before, is a component within plastic, something that you kind of hear as a vague boogeyman. So let's kind of refresh it to what those bisaerophol A's usually are.
BPA sounds like a sexual thing. Like,
it does.
Like ass to mouth.
BPA.
Dude, I met this Costa Rican chick who let me go all BPA on her the other day.
Breast, penis, ass. That's like, I don't know.
That sounds like a gym tan laundry thing, like, but like to a bisexual.
Balls, penis, ass, bro.
I could just be gay. You had to add breast in there, like built in.
Breast, penis, ass. Yeah, gays can use it too. You know who can't use it? The heteros, the breeders, cannot the appropriate this.
Absolutely. The breeders, I've never heard that insult.
You're not down with the gays I am. Guess. You should blow me. Then I could tell you all the things, but you have to do it first, Bill.
So BPAs are used in plastic production as precursors for many plastics and resins. The reason they're so useful is they can be made into very, very tough, but clear and translucent materials.
Sex toys.
Sometimes sex toys.
Yes, they actually can.
Yes, they can. But also, more likely, you encounter them as water bottles. So think how thin the water bottle plastic actually is. Believe it or not, it is actually a fairly modern engineering marvel that we can do something like that. That did not exist pre-World War II. In fact, it took a lot of development to be able to get something that is that thin, pretty much transparent, that lightweight, and yet essentially completely watertight by definition of being a water bottle.
But in many ways, it was also a step backwards from the glass that preceded it. Yes, you could lose a lot in production costs from an accident.
Yes.
But it's much easier to defend yourself with a broken glass than it is
absolutely,
an unbreakable water bottle. Yeah.
That's why you got to just drink beer.
Good call, Bill. Sorry, officer. I have to defend myself at all times. Want to go?
I don't care if I'm a school bus driver. I'm not about to get stabbed by one of these punk-ass kids.
I'm not allowed to open carry in this state. This is how I'm going to protect these kids.
So you might wonder, why do we hear about this as a boogeyman? What's the problem? Well, the problem is that BPAs particularly, but also a lot of the chemicals that are closely related to BPAs, can mimic different types of hormones within our bodies, specifically estrogen, but actually we've actually found more and more within the last few years, different hormones as well. So imagine taking these into your body, which we're doing all the time, as we've talked about microplastics and stuff
sex
like that.
Sex toys.
Yeah, sex toys. Imagine that when you're taking that into your body, that's kind of, in some cases, the equivalent of just taking a handful of hormone pills. Now, BPAs affect things. They're essentially estrogen receptors at a much lower level than estrogen itself, so it's not the exact same. And for a long time, essentially, that's what regulators have been saying. What they've been saying is, yes, we know BPAs can mimic certain hormones and cause issues, but they're very, very light in doing that. They don't have a very strong effect. And yes, we know human beings are ingesting BPAs and they're now part of our, basically our bioculture, our systems and our bodies. That is part of our bodies now. We know that. But what we're going to say is, though we know those two things, it is in such tiny quantities in our bodies that even though, yes, it can have an effect and yes, it's in our bodies, it is not in it at a high enough rate to cause problems. So basically what the FDA has said for a long time, don't leave water bottles in your car or in the sun, because the sun will break down the BPAs in that water bottle. And then when you drink the water, you will get some of those in you. You know, so avoid the stuff. But in reality, you probably don't have anything to worry about. Then this week, a paper came out that should have made us all collectively shit our pants. But nobody reads science media, especially over the holidays. So basically, it just made me shit my pants.
I mean, I shit my pants this week. I didn't read the article.
No, not at all. It was unrelated.
Oh, my God. It felt like somebody just walked over my grave and shit on it.
But how many plastic water bottles do you use weekly?
Sure, that's one thing, but that's not the only way you get BPA. So that would be one thing. Bill, let me ask you, how many times have you eaten with a plastic fork? You know, think how many times your food comes in contact with plastic that you don't even know about because it's the containers that they're being prepared in a restaurant.
Have you been pegged?
I mean, one of the things you don't necessarily think about is how much plastic you actually eat, right? So I'm not talking about leaching into water, but how much you eat. A lot of cutting boards nowadays are plastic cutting boards. Mm-hmm. They're not made out of wood. When you're chopping something up on that cutting board, little bits of plastic, tiny little bits are getting into the food. You're literally cutting it off that plastic board. Right. When you wash it in the washing machine or in the dishwasher, it takes those BPAs and the same water that is going around there is coating all your other dishes that you later eat too. Mm-hmm. So little bits of BPAs are getting in even just from your eating, your consumption, if you never had a disposable plastic water bottle in your entire life. Mm-hmm. So the big deal just happened this week. The paper that should make everybody shit their pants came out and basically said, hey, remember how you said before it affects our endocrine system and it is in our bodies, but it's not in there in a high enough concentration to matter? Turns out you guys were wrong. Mm-hmm. So this is a crazy paper that came out. Now, they didn't start looking at some weird subpopulation of people who had more BPAs than normal. They didn't start finding different types of BPAs we weren't looking for. All they did was change the measure of the test. What does that mean? It means that before, the way we were basically tabulating the amount of BPAs in your body is we would take a urine sample and then...
That's exactly the way you take a measure of a man.
That's true.
Is through a urine sample.
And whether or not he will make a good husband.
Yeah. Taste it.
Yes.
Yep. This guy's a good husband. This guy's husband material.
Tastes like hardworking.
Musty.
Yeah. I'm going to brush my teeth.
Oh, no. I'm not going to marry... That guy tastes like he snores. I don't want to deal with that for the next 40 years. What we used to do is take that urine, and then we would have the metabolites, i.e. what your body breaks these BPAs down into. We would then use another enzyme that we got out of a snail to literally coagulate these metabolites back into the original BPAs and count them up. Well, you can think of a lot of reasons why this is not a very good method of determining actually how many BPAs are in your body. Number one, it means that if you don't have all the metabolite composition of one particular BPA, you're not going to reform that BPA. And therefore, if you know one hydro group got lost in the process somehow, all of a sudden you have a skewed number. Number two is it's an elongated process, whereas if you just count the metabolites that are currently there and can extrapolate back to the BPAs themselves, it's much more direct if you find it. So anyway...
It's also difficult to keep all the lab techs from dipping into all that sexy urine that's sitting around.
Especially if they're eligible females, right? So they're constantly looking for a mate.
Yeah. Nope, that's bad.
Yes.
Bad husband material.
I missed that Big Bang Theory episode.
Bazinga.
Would have literally been the best episode.
Can we write one episode of the Big Bang Theory?
The hook is, this one's good.
Sheldon quits the show. I can't do this. I can't work under these non-hacky conditions.
This research group basically found a way to directly measure BPAs without this whole convoluted using enzymes to reform BPAs for metabolite
Snails
systems.
Snails weren't involved.
And when they did, they found that, A, there's way more in our bodies than we think, and that the more there is in our bodies, the worse this test is. Meaning, if you just have a little bit, it might be off by, you know, a small percentage. Whereas if you have a lot in your body, the old tests are actually off by a big percentage, which means not only are we off, but we're disproportionately off at the people who are most likely to be impacted because they have the highest levels of these estrogen-mimicking chemicals in their body. That is terrifying because it basically means if anybody that we are using or have used this method to test before was actually way high in BPAs and should not have them in their body, is at a dangerous level, literally 100% of those tests would have come back that those people are at safe levels of BPAs in their body. That is terrifying. We should all be collectively shitting our pants and realizing that a bunch of estrogen-mimicking chemicals that are out there and can basically act like hormones are in our bodies at way higher numbers than we previously thought because we were doing a bad measurement.
So Alex Jones was right.
He kind of was.
Water's making the frogs gay.
I'm telling you, it's good to be vindicated. I want my apology right, Mr. Timothy. I'm tired of you talking trash about me, but I've been a scientist.
Alex, I heard you were backpedaling a while ago on Joe Rogan's podcast about the Sandy Hook kids. You didn't actually think they were all faking it. But then, after you left Joe Rogan's podcast, you just started yelling about how he was a shill and you want to fight him in one-on-one combat. Is that still the case?
I originally showed up to fight Joe Rogan, and then he cowered out and tried to record me in a podcast. Okay. And I was very civil. I tried to de-escalate things. But Joe Rogan, and I'm taking off my shirt right now. This is an audio medium, so I have to describe what's happening so the fans know that I'm a red-blooded American.
The shirt does constrain you a little bit.
Exactly. And Joe Rogan was about to get these two Texas pythons.
Now, are you worried that Joe Rogan was the world taekwondo champion of the state of Maine, a competitive kickboxer, and a black belt in BJJ? Does that bother you at all when you're trying to fight him?
Let me tell you what, he didn't fight his way into Bohemian Grove like I did. I cut my way through.
You fought your way into it.
Oh, I caught my way through dozens of Illuminati henchmen. Most of them were probably genetically altered gorillas trained with karate and jujitsu.
Wow, gorillas, they knew karate.
I mean, they were nothing to me. I cut through them like they were nothing but conspiracies by the liberal elite.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you guys. I've already told you that we found out that we were way off in our estimates. What percentage do you think we were off? So were we 10%, was it 10% higher than we originally thought when we looked at the actual BPAs in the blood? Or did we find out it was 25% higher when we looked at the BPAs in the actual blood? What do you guys think? What's your guess for how much higher the actual BPAs we found this week were than the proposed BPAs that from the method, the false method that we've been using for a long time?
My initial answer was going to be $0 because fuck you. I don't like playing your games.
$1,
I have
yes.
to play one. On the next episode.
Uh-huh.
But I'll play your rogue game 1,000%.
1,000%. Okay. 10 times.
I like my way, but it's my way sounds more grandiose.
Fair enough.
I was going to say 200%, but 1,000 sounds pretty reasonable.
You don't say 1,001, Bill.
Did you? I mean, did you read the man. Don't play with my. Don't play me. Don't play the question. Play Bobby. How did Bobby's reaction?
That's right.
No, I'm sticking with that.
Even more, actually. 44 times as much in some cases, in the highest level cases. Imagine that. That would be like saying, hey, what did you drink last night? Oh, I had a beer. Sorry, we looked at the recordings. You had 44 beers. Like, you're not even close, man. Like, one of those, you literally aren't tipsy and have probably absolutely no effects of the actual alcohol. And the other, you are dead, long dead of alcohol poisoning. Yep.
Or a fucking legend. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's fucking crazy. 44 times. God. So now, obviously, that's only in the extreme.
And the only cure for
level.
It's Alex Jones's virility serum. I'll tell you right now, but you can get alexjones.com. I got a lot of lawyer fees, so buy quick.
What these researchers are saying is, if you look at previous groups that have said we don't have to worry about this because the numbers are so low, they were saying your numbers would have to be 10, maybe 20 times as high before this starts having an effect.
And they are.
And they are. Maybe even higher. So this is crazy. We'll see if this has follow-up research that indicates that this is true otherwise. But it is absolutely terrifying to think of the idea that this thing we've been kind of worried about has actually been majorly affecting us for a long time. And when we look at what BPA effects are at those levels, they're absolutely, especially in animal models where we test this, they absolutely have an effect. You are absolutely getting essentially a hormone-boosting effect from that plastic in animal models at that level.
Yeah, but maybe I want a hormone boost. Maybe my estrogen levels, I feel, have been a little low. I haven't been lactating as much as I normally want to.
Explain to you how your body works.
I actually could use this. Yes. I'm not going to make a joke. Please, you tell me how my... What's a penis?
Who are the study participants? And what's like N number stuff?
So in this study, to answer your questions, Bill, they actually looked at two different sample groups. One was synthetic urine spiked with BPA. And then they also looked at 39 human samples. This was a way for them to basically put a relative comparison between human urine and you know, you have a synthetic urine and you actually put BPAs into it. You can do that as a direct comparison to the actual human urine coming out.
So this is that was a test of their test, sort of.
A test of the testing methodology. I mean, this whole paper is a test of the testing methodology, right? Is whether or not you are measuring actual BPAs and what actual BPA measurements are.
And the 39 participants were like somehow randomized?
Mm-hmm.
Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. They found that there were much higher levels of BPA using that direct method, sometimes as much as 44 times. Yeah. That's crazy, right? And so you're right. We could have bigger N numbers. You know, 39 is not huge. You know, we'd like to see that up into the triple digits. But even then, it's not small enough to really, unless these 39 people working at some weird plastic factory, right? Like, that's not going to account for anything.
Or in the military, where all of your water bottles are.
Oh, yeah.
When I was in Iraq, you're talking about this, but I'm just having flashbacks to Iraq, not to the combat.
Sure.
Just to the pallets upon pallets of water bottles stacked 10 feet high in the sun, night after night. Then you're like, well, second platoon needs more water. Go grab a bunch from the pile.
Yeah.
And we throw it on ice. We're like, oh, it's cool. It tastes real good when you, it's good water once you refrigerate it.
Yeah.
But it turns out I was just drinking estrogen.
Yes.
Which I'm still down for.
Yeah. Exactly. That might help with some of your period cramps.
We did cover, correct me if I'm wrong, we covered probably a couple of years back. That plastics that we replaced BPAs with, I think they were BPIs.
Oh, yeah, I remember that story.
Have the same effect
as
BPAs.
They can, right? So, like, they are a little bit better at basically keeping tightly wound up so that the heat doesn't expose them and stuff, but they can still end up having those effects. It's just that BPAs tend to have them in more milder conditions. But yes, we found that even the stuff that they said, like, BPA free, it was just replaced with a different plastic, and that other plastic has very similar features to the first ones.
Right.
So, all of that is terrifying. It might be that plastics aren't a great thing to have in contact with our food. Like, that might be, this might be our version of when we look back to the 1700s and we're like, why the fuck did you put mercury in everything? Like, why are we putting mercury in your food? You know that's not good for you, right? And they're like, what are you talking about? Look at this metal. It's liquid.
It helps make you whimsically mad.
Yeah, our children or grandchildren might be looking back and be like, why the fuck were you eating that? You know plastic is bad for you, right? Like, why would you eat that?
And we've also found out how bad aluminum is.
Yeah.
Too. Aluminium. I apologize to our, to our listeners over the pond.
Yes.
But aluminum, you can't cook with it.
You're not supposed to do that whole, like, cooking fish and veggies in the aluminum foil.
But you can refrigerate items with it, I understand it.
Sure.
But can I eat canned goods? Are canned goods fair game?
You would think so, yeah.
Oh.
I mean, because they're heat pasteurized, they're flash heated, but I don't know if they're flash heated in the can.
Sometimes they are, I think, heat cooked in the can.
And cans aren't aluminum anymore. Cans are like steel and tin, I believe.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
I get my cans of soup made from platinum. Titanium alloys.
Anyway, one of those terrifying things, something that hopefully we'll see follow-up studies on, and then maybe they'll find out, hey, actually, even though we do have a lot of it in here, this is a way to avoid it, or these people had a lot more than we would have normally expected from a random population because of this. So maybe we'll get news later on that this isn't as bad as we think, but right now, this is really bad-sounding news and something you should be aware of, because if we've been told this whole time, actually, disposable water bottles aren't great, but it's not going to really add up in your body, and it turns out it is. Don't ever fucking drink out of one of those again, right? Like, it might be more of a deal than we have made it.
It's also really easy to buy a reusable water bottle and just put water in it.
It absolutely is. All right, let's go on to article number two. Nerds are fighting.
Like Trekkies versus Star Wars, or like...
No, this is...
Like with lightsaber, fake lightsaber?
Yeah.
Are we talking about LARPing? Is that what... It sounds like you're talking about LARPing.
Dude, has one of these guys put part of a pool noodle on the end of an arrow for a bow and arrow?
Look, my liege. Let's punk their ass.
David, you ever get the feeling that like we could just go put on some styrofoam that we got like out of the kids' swim center at Walmart and beat the shit out of a bunch of LARPing people? I was thinking about that the other day because like I went by a LARP. I saw a LARP. I saw a lot of guys doing that, and I thought, I've never LARPed before, but if you give me like a telephone pole size thing of styrofoam, I'm going to beat one of these nerds to death with it.
That reminds me of like, have you ever seen those videos when like one of those giant hornets gets inside of a bee's nest and
it's
just fucking up the bees?
Yeah.
Like they look like the same thing, but they're not the same thing.
Let's do that. I'm going to LARP from now on. Let's start LARPing. All right. So this is a really interesting story. We covered part of this a few weeks ago, and this has to do with the oldest evidence for life on Earth. So we've covered life before, how we can kind of see its traces, how it used to be single cell for billions of years, and how we're not actually sure when life started. This happens to center around some rocks in Greenland that are some of the oldest rocks on Earth, about 3.7 to 3.8 billion years old, so not too long after our collision with Theia and everything kind of solidified. And basically, what has been going on back and forth in the literature since about 2016 is one group publishes and says, look at these rocks. See these little marks in the rock? We believe that these are actually evidence of life, and that would make that the oldest life on Earth. So when you're looking at evidence for microscopic life, you're not going to be seeing bones. So it's harder in paleontology to kind of discern what is or is not life on a microscopic scale. Usually, you're actually just seeing what that life did to the environment around it. So the soft body doesn't preserve, but this is what we're looking at. And that's why this is so kind of contentious.
I mean, would it multicellular life have happened at that point?
No,
or was it
single cell? Single cell.
And do they could tell like a miniature basset hound tracks the scent, or like an old detective Sherlock Holmes type can tell where a bacteria has traveled?
Well, there's an Australian researcher named Alan Nutman, and he believes that there's these wavy patterns that they see are shaped by microbes. Basically, microbes made this kind of wavy sediment layer that we're seeing fossilized.
I learned how to trick microbes from an aborigine. He was a shulman, he was.
And that they form these small little stromatolite structures that we see throughout like, kind of single-cell history time, which is where these single-celled individuals kind of line up and they form these larger structures. And what he's saying is, look, here's evidence of it. Now, there's been a...
Look, here's evidence of it.
There's been a disagreement. That was a New Zealand guy, I think.
An Aussie fan can correct me.
Oh, yeah.
I knew Dwayne, New Zealand Dwayne can correct me. Uh-huh. Who actually told me, I asked him how my New Zealand accent was.
Uh-huh.
He actually said, why does Ken Ham keep speaking Australian? That was his.
Way to go, Dwayne. Yeah, so
at least it wasn't Russian.
In response to that, a whole different group, led in part by some people out of JPL, including Abigail Allwood and some others, have basically said, no, this is just totally natural. Like, what you're looking at is not evidence of stromatolites. It's not evidence of single-cell life. These are kind of natural processes we'd expect to see everywhere. And certainly it doesn't rise to the standard of evidence of claiming you have the oldest life on Earth.
Do they have a particular geological formation that they're pointing to?
They're basically saying your evidence hasn't risen to the level of expectation for this claim. So what they're saying is, you're saying it could be stromatolites, but here are natural phenomena that also look similar, and you can't differentiate between the two in the fossil record.
Okay.
Early single-celled artificial life, like early AIs,
yes.
Robots that... Uh-huh.
We're only there designed to beat us in Pong. That was it. That was their entire AI existence. So they did something really interesting this past year, which was in August. They did something that we should hope all scientists with disagreements do. They literally formed a mega team. Like, they got together and they're like, we want that guy from the Beach Boys. We want that guy from the Eagles.
Like a super group would be, which would be the musical.
Yes, exactly. And they formed one of these as like one big group that ended up having like 10 geologists, some astrobiologists, and other specialists. And they all went there together to do group research. Half of the group basically thinking this is bullshit. Half the group thinking this is life. And all of them working together on site to actually determine what's going on.
There are so many other ways you could have described it than the super group. I would have gone with like the Ocean's 11, like the original scientists shows up at like a LARPing event. There's a guy putting a fake battle axe into a handbag and about to get into his mom's van. He goes, Simpson, you son of a bitch. I'm putting together a crew.
Where are we going? Let me just tell my mother and I'll be off shortly.
And then a nerdy stereotype after that.
Uh-huh. Yes, yeah, exactly. In fact,
Walks in the guy wearing Klingon makeup.
Yeah, one of the guys from JPL was obviously the demolitions expert, right?
And that little Asian guy from Ocean's 11 who acrobatics was on the team too. They don't know what you're going to find.
I'm not sure what you're going to need him for.
He's just interesting to watch.
Did you see him do that backflip? It was fantastic. And it's cute how Brad Pitt can understand him, but he doesn't actually speak Chinese. I'm still trying to figure out which one of these scientists is responsible for knife throwing, though.
That's not the LARP guy. Right now.
Absolutely.
He's going to insist.
Yes.
He's the knife thrower.
Yes.
Do not give him the knife.
No. He actually doesn't know what that means. He just throws bits of styrofoam at you. So they went there and essentially carried out work together. Now, in the end, people pretty much had the opinions that they came into it with. For the most part, the Strident researchers did. Now, the ones that were on the fence kind of seem to have gone to the non-life side of that particular argument, though they're not ruling it out. But both of them agreed on a few things. One is you have to actually be here to see some of these because the two-dimensional pictures you get in papers are not going to make our point. So we didn't feel like either of us could make our point to the other crew without actually being there. That's amazing. Think about that. Two different scientist groups from different parts of the globe. One's in Australia, one's in California. They get together to form a supergroup, meet in Greenland, get helicoptered into a remote site dropped in the middle of nowhere so they can sit there and make cogent arguments to one another with the appropriate evidence at their disposal. This is science as it is written in children's books. Like, this is the way it's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they could have stayed longer? Do you think they could have figured out more if they also didn't have to fly their mothers who also had to fly their inhalers and everything?
Yes, exactly. Like,
and then both Australian mothers and American mothers.
All right, Gary, come on in. Good night, your supper's cold.
Why did we have to fly in 10 special custom-made Padaya shoes? Why did we have to do this?
Did you want the team to come together or not? This was actually, we did not anticipate this being a deal breaker, but it was.
Mm-hmm.
So they went out there and they used aerial photography, stereoscopic images, LIDAR, a whole bunch of stuff to basically try and record the site as well as possible. Because one thing that both sides agree on is that those 2D images do not reflect the actual reality of the situation. It's hard to make your case with those either on either side. And so therefore, you need these really advanced techniques, 3D models specifically, to help kind of show this information later on. So even though the primary researchers disagreed at the end of the day, just like they had when they went out there, they still worked together to form this amalgamation of media that will be everything from, you know, laser scans to 3D images that will then be used to be the formal record of this site for other researchers to be able to determine for themselves. This is a great example of what can happen in science when two people don't agree with each other, in fact, might stridently disagree with one another, think the other person's entire life work is total bullshit, and they can still get together, work together, use their different skills to create as much knowledge as possible about this site, possibly to prove themselves wrong.
You, without knowing it, just described yours and my relationship on this show.
Oh, yeah. We work together to make it happen.
And we both disagree vehemently on things. We don't even like working together.
Yes, totally. Yeah.
But we come together to teach other people and to be good examples.
Uh-huh.
About how to talk about science articles and dicks.
Articles. So they still don't agree.
They don't. And you know, that will eventually get ironed out. I tend, because I've seen, again, the pictures of this. I've seen the arguments on both sides. I tend towards the this is not good evidence of life side. This is certainly not good evidence of life. I tend to it's probably not life as well.
Is movement really the only thing that they could go on? Like,
no, it's not movement. It's actually the structures that are formed by the creature as it lives its life.
But that so
think of it almost like a snail shell, but of minerals and stuff around it.
Oh, okay.
I'm picturing when they're putting together this team, Alex Jones keeps stopping by. Hey, I got any room left on this plane to Greenland?
I'm traveling without my mother. I'm a man. I don't need my mother. Alex, I mean, she's coming, but she's staying in a hotel. And
Alex, it is far too cold for you to be shirtless with leather pants here at the helicopter.
You let me just decide that.
That was him shivering with anger. Yeah, because it's cold.
Yeah, this is a rage. I'm just thinking about them gay frogs.
All right, and for our final bit, we are going to go into a new bit. We had told you before, since we got rid of our intro bits, we have a different third bit every single Sunday show. So this is a new third bit that we haven't ever done before called I Can't Believe We Fucked This Up For So Long.
I can't believe we fucked this up for so long.
All right, this is the perfect science article to debut this new bit. I can't believe we fucked this up for so long is supposed to look at particular things that we as science, we as people, we as a society have horribly fucked up, and for a long period of time for seemingly no reason. And honestly, that itself could be the title of the article we're about to dive into. I think it's one of the most interesting science articles of the week.
On a long enough timeline, the Ben Shapiro podcast. Uh-huh. I'm just picking one at random, a conservative. The Alex Jones podcast.
Uh-huh.
The Alex Jones podcast. You know, the Alex Jones podcast. All right. Will have to have a segment similar to this,
uh-huh.
but admit that climate change. Hey, it turns out we were wrong.
We were wrong. It was caused by the gay frogs.
We now know that. That's just taught in schools now. Alex Jones is saying from a head in a jar.
So this is about the tuberculosis vaccine. This is such an interesting story. I cannot begin to explain to you how crazy it is. By the end of me telling you this story, you're going to say, I can't believe that's fucking real, and Google it. And when you find out that I'm right, you are going to think every scientist you've ever met is an idiot.
Is it that the tuberculosis vaccine causes autism? If so, then I can Google that right now find out that every scientist is an idiot.
You could, absolutely. Wait, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you. You said that in a weird voice, Alex.
I'm sorry. I'm a little nasally right now. It's allergy season.
Thank you.
It's the one thing that can take down this American man.
Let's talk about tuberculosis. We all know it as, like, you know, what Doc Holliday got in the Old West. And not usually part of our lives, because in general in America, it's like 5% or less of people have it. And it's usually those people are closely involved with immigrant communities. So you're usually getting it from outside.
It's a lifelong affliction.
And you at least have the antibodies for it lifelong. So, but it's actually really prevalent in other parts of the world. It affects like something like 10 million people on the face of the earth worldwide. And again, most of those aren't in the U.S. You have huge populations in Central America, Africa, Asia, especially Southeast Asia, in which this goes through the population. It is devastating. Now, most people, I think it's like 90%, will never show symptoms of the disease. We call that latent tuberculosis. You've been exposed to it. You have the bacterium. Tuberculosis is caused by a bacteria. You have the bacterium in your body or in your lungs. You've been exposed to it at some point, but you never get symptoms.
You never get the bloody handkerchief.
Yeah, yeah. But when you actually do develop symptoms.
Or be able to shoot really fast.
Yeah. Yeah. That's symptoms. And just be delightful in cards.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Not to mention banging ugly prostitutes.
There you go.
Listen, people with big noses are people too. And nobody, don't assume anything about my appearance. I have a small dainty nose.
That's right. So this disease, when you finally do get it, if you actually do show symptoms, you're not one of the 90% that have latent TB, you actually have real TB, it's like a 50% mortality rate. So like if you show symptoms, you're fucked, or you're pretty close to being fucked.
Now, is there any sort of broad spectrum atomic bomb
antibiotic
that can kill this?
So yes and no. Yes, we do have medicines that can fight tuberculosis. They're not usually available to the people who are being infected. And one of the problems is that infection areas also strongly overlap with bacterial antibiotic resistance because of poorly taken antibiotics. This is specifically true in Central America, where we've talked about this before. This is something that we got exposed to as young kids because we grew up in southern San Diego, so it was part of our culture. It is very popular in a lot of Latin countries to take a single antibiotic the way you would take a cough drop when you were sick. And that leads to massive antibiotic resistance. So there are real, real hot spots of antibiotic resistance.
That's like the worst thing you could do.
It's incredibly common. It's so common that you get offered them by your friend's parents.
Wow.
Now, who has the worst antibiotic resistant problem? Now, I know Mexico has the problem you just mentioned.
Yes.
And that exists here, but not as culturally spread.
Yes.
But that certainly does happen here. Mm. But we have access, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, uh-huh. to much more powerful antibiotics.
Yes.
So when those get abused, so basically we have, university system. We have the best of the best.
There hasn't been a new antibiotic since 2008, mm-hmm. and there's none in the making right now. So even then, basically most of our stuff is compromised. The issue is more, though, that you're not going to get that stuff to the people who really need it in general. We've been able to fight it in this country because we have things like
well, that's fine. When immigrants come over, we welcome them with open arms and we hook them up with socialized
medicine. That's exactly correct.
So, I mean, if you have a MRSA infection and you're from South America, come on over. We love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We live in a border town. It's great. Actually, and I say that we're actually pro-immigrant. Yes. I'm sarcastic, but we're pro-immigrant.
So we came up with this vaccine about 100 years ago, the tuberculosis vaccine. It's called the BCG vaccine. It's the exact same one we came up with then. Like, we are still using the same vaccine. It's one of the most popular vaccines ever used. In fact, over a billion people have gotten it over the past 100 years.
That's a nice way of saying people in the Western world over the last 100 years.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's one of the reasons we have essentially eliminated it from this country. But it is incredibly successful in stopping a type of tuberculosis that you acquire as a child that's almost always deadly. So in that case, it was a huge success for the vaccine movement because lots of kids used to die from tuberculosis. When they would get it, it would essentially be a death sentence. They would almost always die. It was very, very deadly, easy to catch. Remember, you cough and this thing goes through the air, so it's easy to catch. And if a kid gets it, they would die rather quickly. Now, the invention of this vaccine meant that we were able to save a lot of children's lives, probably millions of lives of these children. Now, this is what we call a subdermal vaccine, meaning it's being shot into your skin and muscle tissue, not directly into your veins. Well, what was really interesting is some researchers were looking at the way TB vaccination works and how it provides immunity. And what they realized is the closer you get to the lungs with that vaccine, the more effective it is. And even though it affects and is really impactful for those kids who have that kind of really deadly form of TB, it's actually really ineffective for adults getting basically the kind of TB you get from, we call it pulmonary TB, what you would get if somebody coughed on you who had TB. It's really ineffective. It does very little. It might give you like 10% effectiveness in terms of that disease. So,
however, if you soaked it in a tampon
yes.
and you inserted it rectally,
yes.
yeah.
you could get fucked up.
So that vaccine is really useful. There's nothing wrong with that subdermal vaccine. That's great that it's saving all those kids' lives, but it's not doing much for us. And it's also not doing much for endemic infections because if you're not stopping adults from catching it from other adults, then you're not going to stop that infection from spreading. Well, what these researchers did when they were looking at it, they realized, the closer we get to the lungs, the more protectiveness it gives adults later on. What if we didn't do it subdermally? What if we did it intravenously?
So that's a good direction to go.
Sure.
But the closer you get to the lungs, the better it is. Why not actually deliver it to the fucking lungs?
Technically, that's what you're doing. Because think of your cardiopulmonary system. If you put something in an IV, it goes right to your lungs.
Because there's so many little blood vessels in the lungs.
Yes, and that's where your blood...
But it's still systematic. Like, it's going everywhere that your blood is...
True, going. But it's cycling... It immediately goes to your lungs. So, like...
Yeah.
As opposed to subdermal, right? So, like...
Sure.
To your point, in order to test this, they thought, let's see what the best method would be. So, let's do a subdermal shot, just like we normally do.
Uh-huh.
Let's do a really high amount of a subdermal shot, so a much bigger shot than we usually do.
Okay.
Let's do an intravenous shot. Let's do an inhaled one, so you're actually inhaling it directly into your lungs, like a pulmonary one. And let's try all these in monkey models and see what happens. So they do all of these different administrations to the monkeys, then they expose the monkeys.
Just to genitals, though, not to the medication. Just scientists opening their lab coats, exposing themselves.
Yes.
Because we are all naked underneath our lab
coats.
Why else be a scientist?
That's the only way to be sanitary.
Uh-huh.
I want underwear soaking up all that sweat. Just let it drop.
Yeah.
It stays on you. If it's on the ground, it's out of sight, out of mind.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's like working out in the farm, right? You have farm clothes, you take all of them off, and then you put on your regular clothes when you're done. Now, you don't want to wear dirty underwear around with your regular clothes.
No.
Do you picture farmers working naked?
I mean,
it's a hot. I want to farm now.
I would assume so.
I suddenly want to move to Iowa and become a Republican.
So what they found was, out of those kind of different variations, the monkeys that got the normal subdermal shots, even the ones that were really big, had very little protection against the adult pulmonary tuberculosis.
A subdermal shot, that's like the one that we would normally think of when you get like shot
in
to the
arm.
Shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
okay.
Perfect. Or in the butt. You know, like one of the ones where you're not looking for a vein.
Yeah.
The ones that were inhaled also weren't particularly effective. The ones that got the intravenous shot. Now, again, this isn't a different shot. This is the same fucking thing we've had 100 years. This is the same shot we've given over 1 billion times to human beings around the world over the past 100 years. When you take that same shot and you move it 2 inches to the left, and instead of going subdermally, you put that right into a vein, not only did the monkeys who were exposed to be never catch it, of the 10 monkeys that were exposed to him, six of them were so resistant to TB that they didn't
broke out of their pens and ripped the penises off the scientists that were exposing themselves to him.
They couldn't even show that those monkeys had even had a colonized infection, meaning their immune system was so good at fighting this infection off that they never even really got the infection. This is fucking crazy. If these results hold up, essentially what we're saying is the exact same tool we've been using for the past 100 years works almost all the time if we use it slightly differently. Yeah. We move that needle half an inch to the left and we could have saved millions of lives over the past 100 years. This is one of the craziest fucking stories that nobody is talking about.
It tells me that scientists 100 years ago either weren't that smart or just wanted to get off early. Like, it's fucked up. We're done.
We're done. Yeah. We are not. What, are we going to stick around and put this needle everywhere? Fuck it. We're out of here.
Because if they stayed late and were like, well, we could try the anus again. No, let's not try the blood. Soak the tampon. What if this happened because, like, during the initial experiment, the scientist who was giving the shot either was afraid of needles, like, afraid of the concept of needles, and just gave a very poor shot and was like, that's how it's supposed to be? I wrote this. I wrote the fucking paper. You want to read it? Yeah, it's pretty long. It's 100 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, it's just bizarre to think that, you know, between 2019 and fucking the Great Gatsby, we could have been doing this differently with a slight twitch of our wrist and saving millions of lives. We didn't have to come up with a new shot. We didn't have to come up with like a crazy new device to administer it. We didn't need some new technique to make it better. It's the same fucking thing.
I'm picturing, all right, well, we've tried it subdermally. Let's go to the other tests on the, hey, you're like the scientist next to him cracks open a beer. It's 3 o'clock. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, homeboy.
Yeah.
Come on, let's go get drunk. It's the 20s. It's the depression. Come on.
Yes. It would be like if you had like a cancer drug that worked mildly to like alleviate some of the symptoms of a particular cancer. And they're like, oh, it turns out if instead of injecting it, you just rub it on your ear, it actually cures all of your cancer and gives you a huge dick. And you're like, why didn't you tell me this earlier?
Tell me more. No, I'm listening. I'm sorry, I peeked my head back in. I left because you guys...
He doesn't have cancer. He just wants the dick part.
I just told me about the dick part.
I want big cancer and big dick.
Could it have been that easier from a healthcare point of view to administer the subdermal
shot? Yes, it totally is. It totally is. But it was done for... They thought that was the effective way to do it. I mean, this is clearly...
Well, they didn't like do a side-by-side comparison like this. Otherwise... Like,
or they didn't do it well, or whatever was going on 100 years ago in clinical testing did not hit the same standards we have now. But regardless, this is crazy new info. I want to see more follow-up studies on this, but if this turns out to be true, that is the biggest example of we've been fucking up for a long time.
Yeah.
Picturing the IRB. Okay, and how are you going to test this? We're going to do it in all sorts of ways. We're going to expose communities of color to it. We're going to infect massive amounts all of the South, black towns. Actually, hold on, wait. We can't get clearance for that. The Tuskegee experiments blew up in our face. You can only use white people. Well, then I guess we'll just use the subdermal. No, we don't want to hurt anybody.
Wait, hold on, dude. We got trucks full of blankets we were sending out to Indian reservations. Are you serious, Bill?
California's getting a real Mexican problem. You sure we can't just deploy out there?
All right. Thank you, audience, for coming back for 393, where you learned all about BPAs, why nerds are fighting, and how we fucked something up horribly for over 100 years. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 394.
Welcome to Greenland. Let me just say, that's not a life. This is a life.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.